Matthew, at the end of his gospel, his biography of Jesus of Nazareth, writes these words. As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph. A common name. It was a common name in that day. Who had himself become a disciple of Jesus, a follower, an apprentice of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. In his book, A Skeleton in God's Closet, author Paul Meyer, who is professor emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Western Michigan University, he presents the idea of what would happen if the bones of Christ were found in Joseph's tomb. In it, he supposes a letter accompanying that find was also found. Listen to these words, written from Joseph, son of Asher, to Nicodemus, son of Shimeon, peace. I hope you are well, friend. I was sorry to leave Jerusalem, even though you wanted me to stay. Arimathea, the home of my youth, serves me well also in old age. I seek only the peace of God before I stand in his presence. To find that peace, I write to you. A painful stone is lodged in the sandal of my soul, and I must remove it. Do you remember the Rabbi Yeshua, whom we know as Jesus, whom we buried in my tomb 67 years ago during the governance of Pontius Pilatus? I could not sleep after the Passover that night. I feared that the noble rabbi, a man of much suffering, would not have the rest that should come to him after his pain. My servants heard rumors in the city that the priests had a plot regarding his body. I feared they might harm or mutilate it. Later I learned that they only wished to seal the tomb. Oh, that I had known. For not many hours before cockcrow, my servant Eleazar and I went to the sepulcher. We removed the body of Jesus and returned the stone to its place. We put the body onto a donkey cart, covered it with logs of olive wood, and returned to my house in Jerusalem. The evening after Shabbat, Sabbath, we drove the cart to Ramah, where we buried again the rabbi in the sarcophagus I had ordered for myself, but not yet taken to Jerusalem. Only later did I learn of the excitement over the empty tomb. Before my Lord, I do not know why the priests did not examine the tomb before they sealed and guarded it. It was empty on the first day of the week because it was empty already the day before. When I returned to Jerusalem, I found you and the other followers of the Nazarene in such great joy over what you thought his resurrection that I could not drown by truth the very buoys that had overcome your sorrow. Forgive me, dear friend. Before I die, I must seek your pardon for hiding the truth these many days. When you read this, I may be dead. If so, I shall be buried not in the sarcophagus with my name, for Jesus is there. But I will be buried in another tomb. May the Lord give you wisdom to use these words properly or to destroy them. Be in peace. Farewell, beloved friend. And then at the bottom, he supposes a note from a man named Nicodemus. I, Nicodemus, am here at Ramah for Joseph's funeral on the 8th of Elul, which would be September 10th for us. I cannot express the great disturbance of my mind and heart. But Joseph's reasonings for withholding the truth are also my reasons. I am burying this letter next to the tomb of Jesus. The truth is now in the hands of El Shaddai, God Almighty. If he wills the truth come to light. If not, then it may be his will that the way, Christianity, survive. For it is a teaching of hope. Amen. A journalist said one time, there are some stories that are just too good to check out. In other words, the truth might be revealed and then the drama of the story is seen for what it is, nothing. And some people regard that when it comes to faith. This is just too good a story to check out because it might not be true. And we don't want to wreck our faith. And so what we've done is said this. What if that happened? What if that happened? What would happen? And for a month, we've been looking at the possibilities of how the world you live in would change and how your life in particular would change. I was thinking this week that the likely process we would go through as a community of faith here is that we would begin the process of divesting our assets. And I think in about 6 months we would close our doors. Because everything we do is on the hope and the reason of the resurrection. Everything. We are not a more spiritual singing version of the United Way. We do everything because of the claim that started this movement 2,000 years ago. He is not dead. He is risen. And I would start giving golf lessons to old ladies somewhere is what I would start doing, because my basis for what I do would be done. It would be over with. At the beginning of this series, we looked at 1 Corinthians 15 when some people were questioning the Apostle Paul, saying there's no resurrection. Jesus didn't rise from the dead. We love him as a moral teacher. We think his the community that his followers have founded is great, but we don't believe that we're anything but food for worms after we die. And he responded back to them in verse 15 or 14 of 1 Corinthians 15. It's the first letter he wrote to this little gathering of followers in Corinth, a city in Asia. If Christ has not been raised, he said, our preaching is useless and so is your faith. I'm not going to church anymore. What we call church. Paul says it's a waste of time. Verse 17, if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. And if you're interested in this phrase, we took a whole week, the first week, to look at this. You are still in your sins. There's a big issue right there. It would be wise, if you're wondering what that means, grab one of those CDs on the way out. It's free. Grab it, because it may alter how you see this whole deal. Then those who have also fallen asleep in Christ are lost. If only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are of all people most to be pitied. Paul said, he goes on to say, if I fought wild beasts in Ephesus for the sake of the gospel, why did I do that? What a nut. No wonder people thought I was crazy. And then he says this, which I empathize with, I embrace this, that if the resurrection were proven to be a falsehood, 1 Corinthians 15:32, he then says, if the dead are not raised, let us eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. If there is no resurrection of the dead, if this life is it, and then your light is snuffed out, and it is as if you did not exist, if there is no resurrection, let us eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Listen to me, friends. If there is no resurrection, Hitler wasn't wrong. You know that? Because it's the survival of the fittest. It's he who dies with the most toys wins. And if you're stronger than I am, there's no reason, there's no ultimate accountability for you not to do whatever you want to do for your own self-preservation, because you're the strongest. I mean, this world starts spinning out of control so fast if there is no resurrection. It would boggle your mind. And above all, what hits you tonight, if there is no resurrection, is hope changes. You see, the word hope is not, boy, I hope it doesn't rain tomorrow because we have a family outing at the park for Easter. Hope is, I already have evidence that it's not going to rain tomorrow. I have a good reason to plan the outing because I'm pretty sure it's not raining tomorrow. I mean, we see what's coming out wet. It's not going to rain. And that's the biblical term for hope. That's the scriptural term for hope. That hope is not something that's like, oh, I hope, I wish this would happen. It's, there's good reason for me to think this happened. And all of a sudden now, if the foundation for all our hopes eternally wiped out, how that goes backwards and affects our life right now is stunning. Because the end is now the end. What you are going through in life right now, what you are struggling through, the hope that you have that it all is not well, it'll be well, that shifts. On the day after Jesus was claimed to have risen from the dead, he meets two guys walking on the road to Emmaus. And it says that they didn't recognize him. And he comes up alongside them and he says, "What are you two talking about?" And they said, "Where have you been? Haven't you been watching the news? We put our trust in this guy, Jesus of Nazareth. We had hoped that he would be the Redeemer that we had been waiting for." But they crucified him, and they said, "And now it is the third day, and we haven't seen him." And then it says this, "We had hoped it would be different." All of a sudden, there is a different "we had hoped." If this is not true, the ground that you have walked on, whether you realize it or not, not just for those of you who believe, for those of you who are not believers in Jesus, the Western civilization that you live in, the rock this has been built on, whether you realize it or not, is Jesus of Nazareth's claim of resurrection. If he is still dead, we long on Saturday for that rock, don't we? Let's listen to these old words. Will you stay standing for just a minute? Because you just experienced at the beginning of this a little bit of the despair of Friday and the longing of Saturday. Is anybody ready for Sunday? Yeah. Turn and say hi to someone before you sit down and we're going to get to Sunday, okay? Just say hi to someone. And just do a big, "Wow, that was depressing for like 25 minutes. Yeah. Because it kind of was, wasn't it? And that's why we did this series, is to say, what would it be like? What did it feel like to think we were fooled? We were fooled. He's really dead and he's not coming back. You know, one thing, we all, some of us believe, some of us don't. We all share one thing. Every single person here is a hopeless hoper. You know, we all are. We are hopeless hopers. We all hope, don't we? I mean, hope is why we get married. Is that not all about hope? You know, when a bride comes down the aisle, she sees three things: the aisle, the altar, and the hymn. And from then on, it's, "I'll altar him. I'll altar him." And that's hope, right? That's all about hope. Hope is why we have children. That's all about hope. Hope is why we send them off to college. That's all about hope, right? Hope is why we buy ab machines. Hope is why we have Botox injections. Hope is why we play the lottery. Hope is why we go to self-help gurus and counselors. And hope is why we play the stock market. Hope is why we open up a Bible that we often don't understand. What is this saying? Hope is why we are here. That's why we're here, is we all can't live a second without some degree of hope. Is there something more? And if it is the end and all is not well, then it's not the end. It's not the end. This is not the end. This is not the end of the story. You see, I think one of the things that is critical about this weekend, that's a fantastic thing, is that maybe more than any other time of year, people have these questions that come up about life and God. This question, like that little guy there has a question he's trying to answer, right? That's a question trying to be answered. And we all have these questions. Let's give them a hand for taking them out of their eyes. I just love that. This is an example for the rest of you. If that happens, you know. I love the story of the two guys who were talking one day. And one guy says, "Well, you know, I'm thirsty. But I don't know if I have enough money for a drink. So let's make a bet. Let's make a bet that that I'll ask a question, and if I can answer it, if I can't answer it, then I owe you a drink. And then you take your turn. And if you ask yourself a question and you can't answer it, then you buy me a drink." And the other guy said, "That's ridiculous. You mean you ask yourself a question and if you can't answer it, you buy me a drink? And I ask myself a question, if I can't answer it, I buy myself a drink?" And the guy said, "Yeah, that's right." He said, "Well, you came up with this cockamamie idea. You start." The first guy said, "Okay. how would a rabbit burrow a hole in the ground without making mud on the outside? The other guy says, I don't know. Answer that question. He says, well, it's real easy. He starts from the inside. The other guy says, yeah, but how can you do that? And the guy said, I don't know. That's your question. He said, that's your question. And so we have these questions that we think they can't be answered because sometimes they feel self-defeating. And then we come to Easter, and it's like the moment where all these questions converge. It really is. If it feels that way, it's because this is the one time a year where one way or another we have to face the questions. Does God exist? Is there right and wrong? Is there heaven and hell? Are we alone? What's up with this whole thing called life? Let's say that you were a tightrope walker and you're about to span Niagara Falls. So could you guys hold on to this one end? Okay, you're about to span Niagara Falls. Okay, sorry about that, but that's a bad toss. Okay, so you're about to span Niagara Falls. And you're about to walk across this cable. And before you go, we say, by the way, it's not attached too well at this end. Just wanted you to know that. And it's not real solid on the other end either. And we've never done this before, so we can't give you a clue how to walk across here, but enjoy the ride. What would you say to that? What would you say to that? Thank you, sir. What would you say? You would say, that person would be crazy to take one step, and yet that's what we do, especially to students in our world. We don't know where you came from. We don't know where you're going. And by the way, you kind of feel your way through this because there's no real way to do it right. But enjoy the trip. Do we wonder why people go, one of the first things I want to do in life is get stoned? Why? It's because this sounds like a farce. Because that's what we're doing. We're saying, enjoy the ride. Grab all the gusto you can. When in fact, all we're doing is rearranging the furniture on the Titanic. Well, let's repaint wallpaper the Titanic. Yeah, let's do that. Well, that seems pretty hopeless, doesn't it? And then comes Easter. You see, there are really four questions that you have to answer. Do you know that? Every human being, I believe, longs for these four questions to be answered. There is the question of origin. Where do I come from? Where do I come from? What's my identity? There is the question of meaning. Why am I here? Why are we walking across Niagara Falls in the first place? There's the question of morality. How do I determine right from wrong? What's the right way to do this? And there's the question of destiny. Where am I going? Where am I going to end up someday? Those questions are always bouncing around. Believer, non-believer, every single one of us has our hearts long for an answer to those questions. That we need some satisfaction from. And then comes Easter. Because the question, where did I come from? Every single one of you are sophisticated instruments. Do you know that one strand of your DNA contains 3.1 billion bits of information? One strand. And yet what we say in our culture is, you know what? You are the equivalent of an explosion in a print factory, and out came the dictionary. Isn't that amazing? You are the byproduct of time and chance and matter. You are like a 747 that came as a result of an explosion in a factory, and out came the 747. Really? When just one strand of my DNA contains 3.1 billion bits of information, and you're saying that I don't really have a point of origin, it was just from goo to you by way of the zoo? Is that what we are? We're just the latest model of the ape? You're telling me that's my identity? And then we go, why do kids act like apes? Why do people act like apes sometimes? And some people wish they would act more like apes, because it would be an improvement, you know? And we go, why is that? It's because we say you don't have any point of origin. You're an accident. And many of us then flesh that out, that identity. We are accidents waiting to happen. But is it possible there is one who said, have you not read, in the beginning the Creator made them male and female. In His own image He created them. And He rose from the dead to say, boom, my word is true. Is it possible? We wonder, why am I here? And we start this walk across this journey and we go, okay, why are we doing this, people? What's this about? And we see all this stuff happening around us and we go, is there any purpose behind this chaos? I mean, is there any reason behind this what so often appears to be randomness? And there is one who says, I will die. I will rise from the dead to validate my word is true. And you know what he said? He said, here's all of life. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And love your neighbor as you love yourself. This is life. That every single day you live, it's an adventure of how can I love God with my mind, with my heart, with my soul, my strength? How can I manifest that love to my world, my neighbor being whoever I'm with right now? Can I do that? And so every single life is pregnant with meaning. I have told our community this, that I came to Christ at age 21 because life was so meaningless. I just, what is the point? And I finally said, well, it's not working without you. Let me just try it with you. That's really what I did. I said, okay, this is what my life without you has gotten me. And I'm telling you, I was a depressed, angry, disillusioned. The way I describe it is headed for playing softball 8 nights a week. And that was going to be my life, boy. And you know what? 30 years later, sometimes I can't handle how meaningful life is. It's just so, every day is just so pregnant with meaning and interactions that have eternal implications and love. I mean, is it possible there's one who died and said, there is meaning. There is a why for why you're here. And if you have a why for living, you can endure anyhow. Do we have a morality? Do we have a sense of what is right and wrong? Is there an objective reference point for right and wrong? That if you step here, you are good. If you don't step there, and if you step here, whoops, not good. That's the wrong move. Is there? There is one who said this. He said, I'm going to die, I'm going to rise from the dead, and I'm going to validate that as the stamp that my words are true. And you know what he did? He stood in front of his followers 40 days later, and this is what the writers say, that he stood up and he said, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. All authority. I am the final word. What I say goes. He said, I am truth. You know what truth is? The definition of truth is reality. That's what truth is. Truth is the way things are. So whenever you buck up against the truth, you're bucking up against the way things are. Not the way you wanted them to be. You jumped off the roof thinking, I don't believe in gravity. Then you run into truth, right? That's the way things are. Gravity is whether you believe it or not. And Jesus said, I am truth. I am the way things are. And I have an objective reference point. As we said in the first week, I don't have to guess, what's a gallon? What's a gallon? When I fill my car up, what's a gallon? I don't know what a gallon is. I don't have to guess. Because in Washington, D.C., there's a standard of weights and measures that says, this is what a gallon is. Nobody can just go off and say, this is a gallon or this is a gallon. No, this is a gallon. And now I have a guide through life to say, this is right, this is wrong, this is right. This is the way to walk through this thing called life and to do it in a way that is best for you and people you're pulling along on your cart as you walk across the falls. Yeah. So there's this whole issue, this whole, have you heard about it, this whole gay marriage issue? Have you heard about that? Have you heard about that? Have anybody heard about that? Are you getting really nervous right now? Yeah, there's this whole issue of gay rights and how people who are homosexual should be treated and da-da-da. And I don't mean to simplify it. I mean, I've read so much on this, and I've taught on this. It's been too long since I've taught on it, actually. But I got to tell you, friends, when it comes to That issue, it's an easy one for me. Jesus made it clear. People who are ridiculed or mistreated because of something like sexuality, who are ostracized because of it, that's an easy one for me. My job's not to judge them, it's to love them. I'm not called to change people. I'm called to love people. If God needs to change people, God will change people. But it's not my job to change people. It's my job to love God and love people. So when it comes to embracing those who in some way feel disenfranchised for whatever reason, that is an easy call for me. I mean, I don't have to wonder, am I supposed to be Jesus' righteous representative to say, you are evil and you're going to hell if you don't turn? No, I'm called to love and say, here's what I think. When it comes to wondering whether or not it's okay to redefine marriage outside of one man or and one woman, that's an easy one for me. Because there's one who said, I am going to die and I'm going to rise from the dead to prove that my word is true, that I am who I said I am. I'll do what I said I would do. And he said, Matthew 19, he said in the beginning, have you not read that he made them male and female in the image of the Creator? He made them, and for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother, be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. It's not hard for him to figure out. What did God intend when he came up with marriage? A man and a woman. I had a professor in college named Sherwood Smith who said, class, he was the most godly man. We were talking about this one day. He's just the most godly man. He said, class, just check the plumbing. I was like, what? Did he just say that? I still remember that. Just check the plumbing, class. You know, and so I don't need to make this the issue that Jesus didn't make. He could have made it a big issue. He just said, this is God's ideal. This is what God wants. Man, woman. And I have a morality. Not because I think, oh, this is what I... It's because Jesus made some things really clear. Really clear. And I have a destiny. I have a destiny. I don't have to wonder, what happens to me when I die? Do I just become food for worms? Is this snuffed out so I got to grab all the gusto I can right now? Because in any time I'm going to be dead? Or do I have a sense of destiny? I love the old story of the three older guys who were talking about, they were at a funeral home, and one of their buddies had passed away, and one of them said, so what do you want people to say when they're standing over us, you know, like this, like we're standing over Joe here? One guy said, well, I want people to say he was a generous man. Another guy said, well, I want people to say he was a family man. What about you, Jim? He said, I want people to look at me in the casket and say, look, he's moving. I mean, don't we all? He's not dead. He found a way around this. Yeah. And so there's this, until you're free from the fear of death, you're not free in life. You're not free in life. The Bible talks about in Hebrews 2 that those who all their lives are held in captivity by their fear of death. There's just always, I'm trying to drown out this reality that someday I'm colliding with the grim reaper and it's just all going to be over and boom. Or is there one who said, I'm going to die and I'm going to raise from the dead to validate that my words are true? And he said, don't let your hearts be troubled, neither let them be afraid. In my Father's house are many rooms, and I go there to design a room for you. And if I go and design a room for you, I go there to be with my Father, and I go there to take you with me that you also may be where I am, for you know the way to the place where I'm going. Is it possible that we have a sense of destiny? And we start out on this journey of life. It's secure in the beginning. It's secure at the end. And we know what we need to do to navigate this dangerous thing called life. Is it possible? Now there's one more question. And the question is, how do we know that's true? The question is, isn't this just like a really good Disney movie? I mean, we just don't really want to, I mean, it's just like a fantasy and this whole idea of conquering death and death not having the last word and Superman coming out of the grave. Isn't this just kind of a great Disney movie plot? Why do we believe? Have you seen that? Have you seen the Oreo commercial? Take a look at this Oreo commercial, because some people approach faith like this Oreo commercial that's out right now. Take a look at this.
What are you doing? licking the cream off these Oreo cookies.
That's stupid. You're wasting the best part.
Says the man without a helicopter.
Wait, don't go.
Choose your side at Oreo.com.
Is that like, is that faith? And we were just, Jesus, take me away. And he's not there, but we're just kind of, it's wish fulfillment, right? It's wish, positive thinking. Just, you know, your distortion reality field. Just believe it's going to be true, and it will be true. It doesn't matter how rational it is. Why? What's the basis? Suppose you were driving down the road someday, and just hypothetically speaking, you and your family were in the car, your kids were in the car, and there was a billboard that said, Jesus is dead. Just hypothetically speaking. Okay? Hypothetically speaking, there's a billboard that said, Jesus is dead. And your little, your 10-year-old son goes, Dad, is Jesus dead? No, son, he's not dead. And I don't know why crazy churches do things like that. And then he would ask the question, well, why don't we think he's dead? Could you give the reason? Well, we just believe it in our heart, son. And he's going to be about 15 someday and go, yeah. Like that's a reason to, we believe it in our hearts. He lives in our hearts. Well, that's great. You might as well have the invisible helicopter. Is there a reason? And I would challenge you this Easter to look at the eyewitnesses and the effects. I would challenge you to look at the reasons. Peter would write, be ready to give an answer if anyone asks you for the reason for the hope that you have. That it's not just wish fulfillment. There is a basis. The eyewitnesses. Look at the life of Simon Peter, who on the night Jesus was betrayed, he denied that he even knew Jesus, even though his Galilean hick accent was giving him away. And 40 days later, he stood up, not very far from where he had denied him, in front of a servant girl who intimidated him, and said, I tell you, God has made this Jesus both Lord of Christ and Christ. I have seen him with my eyes. He is alive. What changed Simon Peter from someone who cowered in front of a little servant girl to 40 days later, he stood up in front of the very people who executed Jesus and said, God has made him Lord and Christ. What changed James, the brother of Jesus, who thought his brother was crazy, to after the resurrection, he became the leader of the Church of the Resurrection in Jerusalem? What changed Saul from a persecutor of Christians? He literally had contracts put out on people who believed in the way. To because he said, I have met the risen Christ, became the predominant preacher of the risen Christ in the world. He became the most effective Christ follower in history. His writings are the basis of Western civilization. What he said, Jesus told him to say. How do you explain that? How do you explain that one day the church did not exist and then one day it did? A movement that would topple the Roman Empire that tried to stamp it out. How do you explain that? How do you explain that we could line up the witnesses who saw Jesus post-resurrection, and from right now till next Friday morning, if they gave their testimony, we could line them up one next to another between now and next Friday morning? How do you explain that? How do you explain the empty tomb? How do you explain that this idea that it was a conspiracy? Charles Colson was a former hatchet man for Richard Nixon during the Watergate scandal. And he eventually, while in prison serving time for his part in the Watergate scandal, he became a follower of Christ, of the risen Christ. And he said, you know why? You know what really tipped me? What really tipped me was when I was going through the evidence and I realized Watergate, the resurrection, Watergate is the reason I believe in the resurrection. He said, six of us, all we had to do was keep this conspiracy quiet. Our lives depended on us keeping this conspiracy quiet, and we couldn't do it. We couldn't keep the conspiracy underground. And it ruined our lives and the lives of many. And he said, for me, if this were a conspiracy, how did these disciples, how did these 11 remaining disciples keep it a conspiracy when their lives depended on recanting this testimony? How do you explain that? And we could go on and on. How do you explain that they went to their death for this claim? If it were a hoax, they would have died for what they knew to be a lie. Now, people die for a lie all the time. Cults and stuff like that, what they think is true. These guys would have known it's a lie. Don't you think about the time when they had Peter upside down on the cross that he was crucified on, that he would have said, fellas, wait a minute. I'll turn state's evidence, but this was just some fun we were having with y'all, okay? I mean, this is not real serious. Do you really think that they all got together and said, hey, guys, let's conspire to create this movement that Jesus is alive. We'll sell a lot of WWJD bracelets, and they'll build big buildings with our names on the side and hospitals, and it'll be worth it. And we'll die for it, but it'll be... Really? Really? I mean, just look at the eyewitnesses. And just look at the effects of the resurrection. We dealt with this in week two. How children are looked at, how women are looked at, hospital care, education, medicine. And I mean, just the effects of the resurrection. Every week from my seat, I get to sit with people who lost their son. And Christ has raised them up in their own life, in their own grief. People who were addicted to cocaine and alcohol. People who lost their companies and continually. People who were on their own path of self-fulfillment. And on and on again, they came to the point where their butt was falling off so bad that they turned to the last hope, the hope of the resurrected Christ. And he changed them. He changed them. He gave them a sense of origin. He gave them a sense of meaning. He gave them a sense of morality. And he gave them a sense of destiny that affects everything in this life. How do you explain the effects of the resurrection? You see, the acid test of any philosophy, does it work in real life? Does it really work? I told a while back about this guy who was a tourist. He went to Chicago and he got in a cab. And the cab driver just boom, blew right on through a red light. And the tourist said, whoa, what are you doing? That's a red light. He said, don't worry about it. My brother does it all the time. It came to another red light, and the cab driver, boom, right through the red light. Whoa, what are you doing? That's a red light. He goes, don't worry about it. My brother does it all the time. They came to a green light. Cab driver stopped. He said, why do you stop? It's a green light. He said, well, you never know. My brother might be coming through. You know? The acid test of any philosophy, any worldview is, does it work in real life? And I'm telling you, people have tried to explain away Christ as a delusion, as a psychological quirk, but the fact is he changes lives. He changes cities. He changes countries. He changes the world. I close with this. Love, love, love this testimony from a man by the name of Matthew Paris. Matthew Paris is a British journalist and an avowed atheist. He is noted for his writings on atheism. And a couple years ago, he wrote this article in which he described visiting the country in which he was born in Africa, Malawi, and his experience there. Listen to these words from an atheist. It inspired me, renewing my flagging faith in development charities. Before Christmas, I returned after 45 years to the country I knew as a boy. But traveling in Malawi refreshed another belief, too, one I've been trying to banish all my life, but an observation I've been unable to avoid since my African childhood. It confounds my ideological beliefs, stubbornly refuses to fit my worldview, and has embarrassed my growing belief that there is no God. Now a confirmed atheist, I've become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in the continent of Africa. Sharply distinct from the work of secular NGOs, government projects, and international aid efforts. These alone will not do. Education and training alone will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is good. Christianity, with its teaching of a direct personal two-way link between the individual and God, unmediated by the collective and insubordinate to any other human being, smashes straight through the philosophical spiritual framework self-defeatingly embedded on the continent of Africa. Those who want Africa to walk tall amidst 21st century global competition must not kid themselves that providing the material means or even the know-how that accompanies what we call development will make the change. A whole belief system must first be supplanted. Listen to this. And I am afraid that it has to be supplanted by another. Removing Christian evangelism from the African equation may leave the continent at the mercy of a maligned fusion of Nike, the witch doctor, the mobile phone, and the machete. Here is an atheist saying, the hope of this continent is Jesus Christ and his followers. Is that not amazing? Is that not amazing? Friends, in Jesus Christ, death, the ultimate enemy, is in the grave. And if that is true, you and I walk out of these doors tonight, no matter what may happen, we have a point of origin. Our life is fixed on this end. We have a point of destiny. It's fixed on that end. And as we walk along the way, there is a meaning, a purpose, and a morality to this life. That means we don't have to be lost anymore. Would you stand up right now as Levi leads us in this song? Death is in the grave.